everyone, welcome to another episode of Textree. It is August and you know what that means. Actually, you probably don't, but if you're Scottish or if you've ever lived in Edinburgh, you will know that August is a time of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which is a famous performance arts festival. I just bring this up, this is not sponsored, I just bring this up because I know a lot of people see August as the fringe month, and it's the month when Edinburgh's population nearly doubles apparently. So I thought, let's do an Edinburgh episode, why not? I love Edinburgh, I lived there less than a year. I don't think I will be able to live there long term, but for a 1 year fling, it was pretty awesome. It is such a good town for anyone that is a history geek, and it has that magic about it that I just think is impossible to find anywhere else. I will admit I have spent a good chunk of my time in Edinburgh just imagining how it looked and felt in the past, because there is just so much history there that you can basically almost smell it. So when I found this text, I was so excited because not only are we getting a description of Victorian Edinburgh, but we are also getting it from a female perspective. And what's cool, because the Edinburgh Old Town has not really changed much since then, and a lot of the places that are described still exist today. If you're ever in Edinburgh, you can just like go and check the places that were described here. Just have a look and think about how it looked back then, because it's insane. So the authoress of today's episode is going to be Isabella Bird, who was a Victorian female traveler. Now that in itself was pretty rare back then, because not only did you need the money and the right mindset to even take extensive travels into consideration, but also you had to be surrounded with people that would allow it, or at least people that you wouldn't mind offending. I'm assuming that female travelers in the 19th century definitely faced incredible difficulties. Even if they weren't traveling on their own, it must have been so difficult. So I always find it really commendable when women in history just persevered and pushed through. Although it must be said that it didn't take just the dream and goodwill to make it happen. I'm assuming a lot of female travelers at the time were extremely wealthy, which just allowed them to take those transatlantic voyages, to sit on a train for weeks on end. Like, these were not necessarily middle or lower class activities. Not to diminish their achievements, because in terms of documenting life, in terms of documenting the world through female eyes, they were definitely pioneers and they left us with so much to work with. But I cannot help but think, what would history be like if the most educational activities were not limited to the upper class? However, I'm still trying to make out how wealthy Isabella actually was, because she did not come from an aristocratic family. She was the daughter of a clergyman, so not necessarily too wealthy. But I do know that her family sponsored her, at least her first trip to the US. And later, I'm assuming she was self-funded, maybe earning money from her books. So Isabella Bird was born near Leeds in the UK in 1831, and she struggled with health issues throughout her childhood, throughout her youth. So at some point, doctors were like, listen, this air is not doing anything for you. You kind of need to go abroad. And Isabella was like, I don't know what the logic is behind it, but go off, I guess. Sure, why not? So aged 23, she went on her first international trip to the US, and she documented that trip in her book, The English Woman in America, which I'm not saying someone turned into a song chorus, but I'm just saying, I'm an English woman in America. Like, come on. Anyway, the book was pretty successful, and she went on to travel to so many places, Australia, Hawaii, all around Asia. She was, apart from that, she was generally speaking pretty badass. Like, she once rode 800 miles through the Rocky Mountains in the US on a horse. And guess what the press focused on? The fact that she dared to ride astride and that she was apparently dressed like a man. That's what I mean when I say that it was hard back then. Anyway, during her time in the mountains, this is not in any way related to the book, but it's just so interesting. During her time in the mountains, she had a potential romance with the Rocky Mountain Jim, an outlaw with one eye, and he was shot dead like a year after she left the mountains, which I think is already enough for a movie plot, even if we don't talk about her travels and her career. But anyway, she did it all. She walked through jungles, she climbed mountains and volcanoes, she got married at the age of 50, and she picked up photography at the age of 60, which resulted in a lot of incredible images that were documenting remote places. We really don't have a lot of photographs from that time, from those places, so like any photograph counts, and she was actually really good. So today we are reading Notes on Old Edinburgh from 1869, so when she was 38 years old. This was her second book after a couple of like shorter texts, and she read Edinburgh's Old Town to filth. But to be fair, 19th century Edinburgh was not for the faint of heart, as we will soon find out. It was horrid. So I don't think you're ready for whatever she's describing, but this is really, really, really bad, really bad. So be prepared. It has been my fortune to see the worst slums of the Thames district of London, of Birmingham and other English and foreign cities, the waterside of Quebec, and the Five Points and Mud Huts of New York. And a short time ago, a motive stronger than curiosity induced me to explore some of the worst parts of Edinburgh. Not the very worst, however. Honest men can have no desire to blink facts. And no apology is necessary for stating the plain truth, as it appears to me that there are strata of misery and moral degradation under the shadow of St. Giles' Crown and within sight of Knox's House, more concentrated and unbroken than are to be met with elsewhere, even in a huge city which, by reason of a district often supposed to have no match for vice and abjectness, is continually held up for public reprobation. She mentions St. Giles' Crown and Knox's House. Those are all places within Edinburgh's Royal Mile. I'm assuming back then it was not called Royal Mile because she does not mention that name. But it's basically the very, very main, very central Old Town Street that leads from the castle to the palace. The Reverend R. Maguire, rector of St. James's, Clerkenwell, accompanied me through a portion only of the district visited. And he expressed his opinion then, and since more formally in print, that more dirt, degradation, overcrowding, and consequent shamelessness and unutterable wretchedness exists in Edinburgh than in any town of twice its size, or in any area of similar extent to the one explored, taken from the worst part of London. With this opinion, my own convictions cordially concur. We all know like what Victorian London looked like. We've read Dickens, but she's saying Edinburgh was 10 times worse. In company with two philanthropic gentlemen who did not hesitate to expose these social plague spots, and guided in one mysterious locality by one of the lieutenants of police, I explored at various times several closes in the High Street, Cowgate, and Westport, going by house row. In all cases, the people were civil and willing to admit us, and few allowed us to depart without expressing a hope that some good would come out of the efforts proposed to be made for them. In many houses, only the children were at home, but they answered our questions with such quick comprehension and painfully precocious intelligence that we were not left in doubt as to the circumstances of their parents. It was a dry, warm morning. No rain had fallen for some weeks. The district might have looked cheerful, had cheerfulness been possible. So great was the contrast between its aspect now and its look on a wet, murky autumn day. The appearance of the lower part of the High Street was as little pleasant as usual. Knots of men who never seemed to move on stared at the passers-by on the South Bridge. Bold girls lounged about and chaffed the soldiers. Careworn women and little girls, hardly less careworn, stood around the well with their pails. Some of the last, we learned, having stood there for 2 and 3 hours. There were dirty little children, as usual, rolling in the gutter or sitting stolidly on the curbstone. As usual, haggard, wrinkled, vicious faces were looking out of the dusty windows above, and an air of joylessness, weariness, and struggle hung over all. The above-named well, close by John Knox's house, is a sign of one of the standing grievances of this district of Edinburgh. It is the water supply of the large population living in those many storied houses, which give the immediate neighborhood its picturesqueness. If it could tell the tale of one day, we should have plenty of the sensational element, but it would be the true tragedy of the real, suffering, everyday life of the poor. As a horde of thirsty pilgrims struggles for the first draught of the water of the bright oasis of the desert, so this crowd often struggles for the first turn at the tap. Here the weakest go to the well. Here children carrying buckets nearly as big as themselves are sometimes known to wait from 1 to 5 hours for the water which is to wash their faces, cook the food, and quench the thirst of the family for the day. Here they wait, losing time and gaining a precocious familiarity with evil from the profanity and depravity of the talk and chaffing around them. I never took this into account that in living conditions as bad as Edinburgh's old town, which as you will soon find out was insanely overcrowded, people lived in absolutely inhumane conditions. I never really thought about the struggle that having water would be. Like, imagine spending hours daily just queuing for water, just so you could wash your face, cook your food, drink, not die of thirst, basically. And then that's what children had to do because the mothers and the fathers were probably busy working or just lying drunk somewhere. Absolutely insane. To this well, the aged widow, who struggles hard to keep up appearances with her white mutch and neatly pinned black shawl, totters with her pail down her dark stair of 150 steps, up the steep close and down the street, waiting with the patience born of necessity in the heat or the rain or snow, as the case may be, till the younger and stronger have got their turn, and then stumbles with failing breath up her stair, the water, which is precious as that of the well of Bethlehem, spilling as she goes. At what a cost does she buy the whiteness of her mutch? Mutch is basically a cap. Hither comes the young, weary-looking mother, having locked up her young family in her eyrie. Heavily burdened with care she looks. She is slowly dropping out of her cleanly habits. Can we wonder? She thinks twice at least about scrubbing the floor, and it isn't much use to wash her children's clothes when they have no place to play in but the gutter. Here also come the small children with jugs and hang about for a frolic, learning to curse and swear and imitate the vices of their elders, if they have not learned them before. It is a pitiful sight in the street, but followed to the homes, this lack of water helps to degrade. Pity for the sufferers mingles with indignant surprise that proprietors of the least paying property to be found, for so the clothes are, have not been compelled ere this to have at least a pipe and tap in every close. So closes in Edinburgh are just those really narrow streets that are usually connecting to other streets from what I've noticed, but they're basically those very narrow, dark alleys. And they usually also have stairs leading downwards from the old town, which is on a hill. Outside the great reformer's house, she's referring to John Knox again, is the well of pure water, difficult of access for most, nearly inaccessible at times to the feeble, the diffident, and the old. Under the same house is the whiskey shop, easy enough to reach, and the whiskey all too easy to procure, only the laying down a few pence and the fluid which makes life brighter for an hour is at the lips without waiting or scuffling. How can our sad and sorely tempted ones escape the snare? Limited water and unlimited whiskey, crowded dens and unwholesome air. We need nothing more to make a city full of drunkards. She makes a good point about water being so inaccessible that it makes total sense for people to buy stronger drinks that you can just buy. You can just walk in and buy. And I'm assuming you couldn't just walk in and buy water at the time. We followed this water grievance into 37 houses that day, and there was scarcely one in which it was not enlarged upon. Did our eyes wander around a room ever so stealthily, its occupier was ready to forestall the glance by saying, I'm not going to attempt a Scottish accent here, so... Ah, sirs, it's the dirt you're looking at. But how's poor folk like us to be clean as has to haul every drop of water from that well? Bid we shrink ever so slightly from a child whose head and clothing were one mass of dirt, the movement was perceived, and the want of water, the distance from the well, and the long, long stare were the apologies offered. I merely give one instance, which might be multiplied almost indefinitely, of the distress arising from this comparatively little thought of cause. In a wretched den on the seventh story, none the brighter or lighter for being nearer the skies, for it had no direct light, a family consisting of father, mother, and child of 3 years old were fighting a hard battle for life. So they all lived in places that didn't even have windows, basically. On the floor, on a straw bed, the husband had been down with fever for 6 weeks. He was wandering and murmuring incessantly, "Drink, drink," clutching all the time at a tin pitcher by his side, which contained water. He was too weak to lift it, and his wife, who expected shortly to become a mother, was helping him to it every 3 or 4 minutes. The bairn is a child in Scots. The bairn was crippled and mentally deficient and kept crawling into the ashes, which I'm assuming were hot, so that between it and her husband, the poor woman had not a moment's rest. So she basically had to run from her husband to the child, which was disabled, to keep the child from burning itself and to keep the husband from dying. On a line across the room, a half-washed sheet was hanging, steaming as it dried. The atmosphere in the room was poisonous. The woman said, "Ah, you are feeling the smell. Sometimes I think he'd get better if we could have things clean about us. He's got bed sores, and you see they run a good deal, and I'm such a weak body I can't haul water enough to wash it out of the sheets. He drinks nearly all I bring, quarts a day. He was always so fond of the water, he never tasted the whiskey in his life. He's been a good husband to me, and since we've come here, I can't get the water to keep him clean." Wait, so this woman is not only heavily pregnant, she needs to haul tons of water to her dwelling, and the water is not enough to wash her husband's sheets that are covered with pus coming out of his bed sores. This is horrific. And on top of that, she has a disabled child that she has to actively keep from hurting itself. In answer to inquiry, she said she had waited half an hour at the well the night before, and in coming up the long dark stair, a drunk man had pushed against her and upset the whole pailful. On our expressing some sympathy, she burst into tears, sobbing out, "Oh, God only knows what it is to slave after the water. It's killing me and him too. And in the glen we came from, the bonny burn ran by the door." In that moment, some cruel memory contrasted that foul, steaming sheet, whose poisonous fumes nearly overcame the strong, with linen washed on the grass by the burn, over which the birch and harebell trembled, and bleached afterwards by the sun to the whiteness of snow. They were evicted crofters from Perthshire, and misfortune, not drink or vice, had brought them so low. Our sanitary reforms are too late for them, for both went shortly afterwards to the land where they shall thirst no more. Like, morally, they didn't really do anything wrong. They probably just made some bad decisions and were evicted from their, basically, farm and had to move in the city because it was cheaper. But they still ended up in this situation. And then, I'm assuming she alluded to the fact that they both passed away. What happened to the child, though? Probably nothing good. But this description just hits me so hard. She describes different rooms after, which all sound absolutely awful. But this, for some reason, just makes me so emotional. Just thinking about the torment of this poor woman and, like, the conditions in life, the struggle, the daily fight for even a pitcher of water. Absolutely horrendous. It's so bad. This water grievance, which exists not only in the Canongate and High Street, but in the Cowgate, the Grassmarket, the Westport, and elsewhere, involves female slavery in Edinburgh of the most grinding description, and consequences from which the moralist and the philanthropist may well shrink. This want of water involves not alone a slavery which in many cases knows no Sabbath, and dirt which is a help to degradation, but an absence of all arrangements for decency. Looking at this subject from a stranger's standpoint, it seems perfectly credible that the lack of all proper water supply in these crowded districts, the impossibility which it creates of preserving physical self-respect, and the evil influence on the young of the wait at the wells, is one among the many causes of the lapsing of the masses in Edinburgh. I like how she notices that they should deal with the causes and not the consequences. Like, you need to start working from ground up. So she's like, okay, these people have no water, these people have no sunlight. There is, like, sanitary-wise, it's a mess. So obviously, if they're all sick, thirsty, and annoyed, they are going to turn to drink. So it's not like, oh, a bunch of alcoholics moved to the old town and they're destroying the city. But it's more like, what happened that they turned out this way? There is no way they could turn out differently. And she focuses a lot on children because these are no conditions to bring up children, and they will turn into the same people that their parents were. So she focuses a great deal on that later on. In the old town, where the population of a village or a fashionable square is constantly crammed into the 6 or 7 stories of one house, room-to-room visitation, for it is nothing else, affords a visitor in one morning a glimpse of a state of things without a parallel. In no other city could tenements be found without gas, without water pipes, water closet or sink, or temporary receptacle for ashes, and entered only by one long dark stone stair, which returned such enormous profits to their owners as from 45% to 60%. Scarcely elsewhere does one roof cover a population of 290, 248, 240 persons living in dense, honeycombed out of larger rooms, without ventilation, without privacy, and often without direct light. In no other city is the respectable mechanic compelled, for want of house accommodation of a proper kind, to bring up his family in a tenement which deserves indictment as a nuisance, or to pay £5, £6, or £8 a year for a den swarming with vermin, with only a wooden partition to keep off the sights and admit all the sounds of haunts of the most degraded vice. In Edinburgh, which in more respects than one is set on a hill and cannot be hid, there are 13,209 families, comprising not only the vicious arid abject, but large numbers of the poorer labouring class, living in houses of but one room, and of these single rooms, 1,530 are inhabited by from 6 to 15 persons. She's saying that over 1,000 rooms that were rented in the old town were inhabited by 6 to 15 people. Can you imagine? 15 people in one room. Insane. Further, by the last census, 120 of these shelters, for they are not houses, were reported as without windows, and 900 were cellars, nearly all of them dark and many damp. The thing about Edinburgh is that if you didn't mind dampness before you lived there or moved there or spent some time there, it is going to get to you. The dampness was primarily the reason I moved back, because honestly, I thought to myself, you know, I'm a Polish person, I can stand the cold. No, it was too much. And knowing how bad it was, and it was probably much worse back then because all those houses were not insulated in any way, it sounds like hell. If there is one place where the dampness is unbearable, it's Edinburgh, not gonna lie. These figures give the astounding result that the families living in one room and often herding together in closer proximity than animals would endure comprehend 66,000 persons, or considerably more than one-third of the population of Edinburgh. The notes which follow are merely a commentary upon the above facts. My room-to-room visitation on a single day included 37 families residing in a close south of the High Street and 10 families in a close south of the Cowgate. I do not give the names of either, in deference to the feelings of respectable persons who are compelled by various causes to reside in them. Slay Isabella protecting her interviewees' privacy, but also I'm so curious which exact closes those were, because I want to see them nowadays, but I guess we'll never know because she was just too polite. The entrance of the close which we selected is long and narrow, and so low as to compel a man of average height to stoop. It is paved with round stones and from the slime in which they were embedded. And from a grating on one side, almost choked up with fish heads and insides and other offal, a pungent and disgusting effluvium was emitted. The width of this close is 4 feet at the bottom, but the projecting stories of the upper houses leave only a narrow strip of quiet sky to give light below. A gutter ran along one side of the close against the wall, and this, though so early in the day, was in a state of loathsomeness not to be described. Very ragged children, infinitely more ragged and dirty than those which offend our eyes in the open street, were sitting on the edge of this gutter, sitting as if they were meant to sit there all day, not playing, not even quarreling, just stupefying. Foul air, little light, and bad food had already done their work on most of them. Blear eyes, sore faces, and sore feet were almost universal. Their matted hair and filthy rags were full of vermin. Ew! Oh, I feel so bad, but it's also so disgusting. Their faces were thin, pinched, and precocious. Many of them had been locked out in the morning when their mothers went to their hawking, washing, and other occupations, and might be locked out till midnight or later, as we found on the following night. They were locked out of their lodgings, mainly, I'm assuming, because it was still better to be sat outside, because inside there was no light, there was heaps of ashes that could not be disposed of, and it was damp. So, I mean, why not? It's still the better choice. There they sat, letting the slow, vile stream in the gutter run over their feet. And there they were, sitting 3 hours later. They were from 3 to 10 years old. It is all the same if the rain or snow is falling, except that they leave the gutters to huddle together in the foul shelter of the stair foot. Some of these will die. Many will be educated into the hardened criminality of the often imprisoned street boy. Many will slide naturally into a life of shame. And a fortunate few will be sentenced to reformatories, from whence they come out decent members of society at the rate of 70%. God help them, exclaimed a mother, so drunk that her own babe seemed in peril in her arms. Aye, God help them, but our Father, which is in heaven, charges the responsibility of their destiny on the respectable men and women of Edinburgh. A lot of the times she is calling out the rich people of Edinburgh for not doing anything. And it does seem like she was shocked by how indifferent they were to what was going on in their own town, as we will hear later. But now she is describing different rooms in one house. We entered the first room by descending 2 steps. It seemed to be an old coal cellar, with an earthen floor shining in many places from damp and from a greenish ooze which drained through the wall from a noxious collection of garbage outside, upon which a small window could have looked had it not been filled up with brown paper and rags. There was no grate, but a small fire smoldered on the floor, surrounded by heaps of ashes. The roof was unceiled, the walls were rough and broken. The only light came in from the open door, which let in unwholesome smells and sounds. No cow or horse could thrive in such a hole. It was abominable. It was nearly dark at noon, even with the door open. But as my eyes became accustomed to the dimness, I saw that the plenishings consisted of an old bed a barrel with a flagstone on the top of it for a table, a three-legged stool, and an iron pot. A very ragged girl, sorely afflicted with ophthalmia, I checked and it says it's an eye inflammation, I didn't know, stood among the ashes doing nothing. She had never been inside a school or church. She did not know how to do anything, but did for her father and brother. On a heap of straw, partly covered with sacking, which was the bed in which father, son, and daughter slept, the brother, ill with rheumatism and sore legs, was lying moaning from under a heap of filthy rags. He had been a baker over in the new town, but seemed not very likely to recover. Basically, Newtown was built in the Georgian era, and it was supposed to be an answer to like the overcrowding of the old town. But obviously, since those were like new fancy buildings, all of the rich people moved there, and the old town got even worse. It looked as if the sick man had crept into his dark, damp lair just to die of hopelessness. The father was past work, but sometimes got an odd job to do. The sick man had supported the three. It was hard to be godly, impossible to be cleanly, impossible to be healthy in such circumstances. She mentions hopelessness, and I didn't really think of this word before, but that's basically what it all is. There was no hope for change. Even if someone came in and was like, no, we need to do something about it, those type of reforms take years. And by those years, all those people would be gone. They could not live in those circumstances longer than a couple of years. There is no way. There is like too much illness, too much bacteria, not enough hygiene for them to survive. So basically, there was no hope. The only hope would be a millionaire coming over and being like, yeah, I'm taking you out. I am going to buy you a house and I'm going to get you there. And then if you do not have an alcohol addiction, which would be difficult to cure back then you'll be fine. But that never happens. That's a fairy tale. The next room was entered by a low, dark, impeded passage about 12 feet long, too filthy to be traversed without a light. At the extremity of this was a dark, winding stair which led up to four superincumbent stories of crowded, subdivided rooms. And beyond this, to the right, a pitch dark passage with a room on either side. It was not possible to believe that the most grinding greed could extort money from human beings for the tenancy of such dens as those to which this passage led. They were lairs into which a starving dog might creep to die, but nothing more. Opening a dilapidated door, we found ourselves in a recess nearly 6 feet high and 9 feet in length by 5 in breadth. It was not absolutely dark, yet matches aided our investigations even at noonday. Okay, 6 feet high, so that's like 182 centimeters, and 9 feet by 5, so 45 square feet, so that's 4 square meters. She is describing a room that is 4 square meters. There was an earthen floor full of holes, in some of which water had collected. The walls were black and rotten and alive with wood lice. There was no grate. The occupier was a mason's laborer with a wife and 3 children. There is 5 people, including 3 children, living in a room that is 4 square meters. I don't even... How would they even... It's so bad. He had come to Edinburgh in search of work and could not afford a higher rent. The contents of this lair, on our first visit, were a great heap of ashes and other refuse in one corner, some damp, musty straw in another, a broken box in the third, with a battered tin pannikin upon it, and nothing else of any kind, saving 2 small children nearly nude, covered with running sores, and pitiable from some eye disease. Their hair was not long, but felted into wisps and alive with vermin. Oh, I hate when she describes this because it's just like she could literally see it move. Like she walked in there and it was almost completely dark, and still she could see the children's hair move. When we went in, they were sitting among the ashes of an extinct fire and blinked at the light from our matches. Here, a neighbor say they sat all day unless their mother was merciful enough to turn them into the gutter. We were there at 11 the following night and found the mother, a decent, tidy body, at home. There was a small fire then, but no other light. She complained of little besides the darkness of the house and said, in a tone of dull discontent, she supposed it was as good as such as they could expect in Edinburgh. I laughed because it is still sort of the case. Like, obviously, the properties are not that bad anymore. Like, I don't think you would have, like, wood lice in walls and garbage juice dripping off the wall. But it's still very much the case that Edinburgh has a housing problem and all of the big cities have a housing problem. And it's very much a known problem that we pay a lot of money for dwellings that are not up to standard. So I just find it really funny that she just described the worst room possible. And then the woman is like, yeah, I don't think you can get much better in Edinburgh for this price. Like, honestly, this is not bad. Personal story time. I was trying to rent a room in Edinburgh before I moved there, and it was so difficult that at one point I viewed a room that was moldy, like there was literal mold on the windows, and I was like, I don't know, maybe I should take it. I mean, it's actually not that bad compared to the others. And then I texted the landlord and she was like, oh no, it's already gone. Like, someone just took it 10 minutes ago. So this is how bad it is. People are fighting for moldy rooms. And that was a while ago. That was like over 7 years ago. But that's still pretty much the case. It's probably much worse now. So nothing has changed. We still overpay for awful conditions. And we are like, yeah, I mean, you can't really expect much better. These two layers were the worst specimens of basement story rooms in that close. But the rest were not much better, and their occupiers, all Scotch, were equally poor. Medical men, with that noble spirit of philanthropy which adorns the profession in Edinburgh, know these dens, and the city and parochial missionaries, wearied and discouraged, still speak to the dwellers in them of one who is mighty to save. But they have long cried to the rich, to the men and women of leisure, to the churches, come over and help us. They ask people to throw aside their theories, to cease wrangling over the cause and try a rational cure, to give the poor not what the rich and benevolent like, but what the poor know they need, and that is houses to dwell in, not dens to rot and perish in morally and physically. Blissful ignorance of the abyss of preventable misery which exists in Edinburgh is impossible now. There are many divers at work, and not one returns to the surface without bringing some cumulative proof of the wreck and ruin below. Again, she's calling out the rich. She's like, why don't you guys do something? This is ridiculous. And in the next paragraph, she makes an interesting point about resocialization. Leaving these basement dens, we entered another close. Though the light in the close was little better than twilight, several women were standing outside the houses mending and patching. They said they could not see to do a stitch indoors. There were many children sitting in the gutters, very dirty, ragged and sore-eyed. These, the women said, were the children of parents too poor to provide them with clothes fit to go into the street. Out of 62 children of families visited in this close, 20 only are reported as attending school. So these children who don't go to school and are too ragged to be sent to disport themselves in the street spend their time between the crowded dens upstairs and the narrow, filthy close. For filthy it was, even at midday, although it was paved and the scavengers had not finished their work more than 5 hours before. These children have never known cleanliness or decency. The happiness which comes from chasing butterflies, rooting up pig nuts, and making daisy wreaths has never come their way. Or even the less Arcadian jollities of trundling hoops, playing at marbles, and making dirt pies, in which city children delight themselves elsewhere. But these are cribbed, cabined, and confined by the high black walls, and as a mother said, they are learning the devil's lessons well. It is no exaggeration to add that many of them are as absolutely ignorant of love as they are of cleanliness, decency, and happiness. Locked out into the cold or wet, scantily clad, kicked about in the morning, kicked about at night, cursed instead of kissed, utterly neglected in body and soul, they grow up attaching no meaning whatsoever to the words love and home. The winds and closes are swarming with them. The ragged and industrial schools, when they get hold of them, are fain to withdraw them by night as well as by day from what in mockery are called their homes, if they are to do anything with them. As long as these are suffered to be born and reared in dance, so long must we build prisons, reformatories, and Magdalene asylums to teach them at enormous cost the decencies they have never known. I think what she's saying is basically, if we fixed the root of the problem, we wouldn't have to spend as much money later on fixing the consequences of the problem. And that's still something that is very much present in modern discourse about poverty or social issues, is why are we only focused on the consequences of the problem instead of like looking at the core of it? And then it would save us money as well, money and time. And yeah, what she's saying is it's much more difficult to fix those children's lives when they've already been broken than to prevent them getting broken. The smell of this clothes was intolerable. How can it be otherwise when all the solid and liquid refuse which has been accumulating in the densely packed habitations during the day lies in the narrow clothes from 10 at night in such quantities that the scavengers not unfrequently remove nearly a ton of it at 7 in the morning, and the ground and the foundations of the houses are saturated with the liquid refuse and drainage. When she describes stuff like that, I just keep thinking, but she was like a well-dressed lady. She walked into these closes and she didn't mind. She was like, that's for science. I wonder if she wore shorter skirts just in case, if she wore leather boots just so she could wash them. But it's incredible to me that she was just like, yeah, I'll do it, you know, no problem. I don't think I could, honestly, I would just throw up. So I don't think the smells that she witnessed were like anything that we could witness nowadays in terms of how awful and strong they were, because I do think our garbage is definitely different to whatever they were dealing with. Plastic doesn't smell. I don't know. I just think it's really brave of her. Because mentally, obviously, it was also a toll, but even physically, how do you overcome just like the urge to run away? I only give a sketch of the general conformation and circumstances of the lands in this close, premising that the description, often very much darkened in tint, however, applies to a majority of the old town abodes, which in Edinburgh are considered good property and fit for the stowage of human beings. It is supposed that not fewer than 40,000 people live in habitations not superior to, and often much inferior to, the lands hereafter described. Clerkenwell itself, Whitechapel and Lambeth can furnish enough of misery and crime, but it is not believed that any city in Europe contains an area of wretchedness so large and unbroken as Edinburgh. In other cities, the miserable dwellings and their inhabitants hide themselves out of sight in obscure purlieus, scarcely known to the rich by name, much less by observation. Here, the very core of all is the high street of the city, with a royal palace at one end and a royal castle at the other, and studded down the whole of its picturesque length with public buildings. Here are the courts of law, the parliament house, the city chambers, the assembly halls of the established and free churches, the cathedral, numerous places of worship, some of which at least are or were fashionable, newspaper offices, printing establishments, and one of the most frequented shops in the city, the wholesale and retail establishment of Duncan McLaren and Son. Thus, instead of being hidden away, the wretchedness and vice of the High Street and Canongate obtrude themselves on all passers-by, from the representative of royalty to the summer swarm of tourists from all parts of the world, who return to their own cities rejoicing that they are not as the metropolis of Scotland. She makes a really good point, and I've been thinking about that too, how usually it's the outskirts of the city or at least some poorer districts that are usually not central that used to be plagued with poverty. But in Edinburgh, it's as central as you get. There's like no area that is more central than High Street, than Royal Mile. So it was always incredible to me. The contrast must have been incredible. Like imagine being a tourist and you go, oh, let's go to the central area of this beautiful town. And you go there and it's just slums. And you're like, oh, I didn't actually expect that. Like you're trying to do some sightseeing and you see dying children. That was not your intention in coming to the city. So I do absolutely agree that it must have been such hypocrisy for all these public institutions to be there. So everyone that could decide on the fate of these people was walking these streets every day and they just didn't look. They just didn't care. But it is not from such casual visitors that the amelioration of the condition of the poor is to be expected. Not on them that the responsibility rests. It is on the gentlemen who cross the High Street daily to lounge in the Parliament House, on the literati who frequent one of the finest libraries in Britain, on the antiquarians who explore the winds and closes in search of an ancient inscription or a remnant of a cornice, on the hundreds, both ladies and gentlemen, whose avocations continually carry them to the various public offices in the High Streets, on all who see and all who hear. It is difficult to comprehend such intense apathy after all that has been written by the daily press, private individuals, and lastly, by the Society for Improving the Condition of the Poor, to show the thinly crusted abyss over which people are disporting themselves. If there be another thing more mournful than the poverty and immorality of the poor, it is the vicious selfishness of the rich. It is observable in Edinburgh, as well as elsewhere, that the upper classes indulge very freely in the expression of opinion on the dirt, vice, and improvidence of the poor. But the lapsed masses of the old town have a public opinion also regarding the selfishness, heartlessness, and indifference of the rich, and express it without much reticence of phraseology. She read them to filth, as she should, because what the hell were Edinburgh people doing back then? I think with every historical text, there is always things that just sound very modern. And this last paragraph definitely sounds very modern because we still struggle with that. Like, we still have to petition the governments to do something. We still have to ask the rich to maybe give us a little bit of their money that they don't need. And it's still a debate. So anyway, this was a tough read, not gonna lie. This was a difficult read. First of all, I don't think I've ever read poverty described in such detail. And it's interesting because usually when it is described, it's fiction. It's like Dickens, it's newspaper boys, but this is actually gruesome. And I'm really impressed how brutal her descriptions were for the era, because especially with female writers, I feel like most of the time they were trying to be like subtle. They were trying to be very poetic. She literally describes illnesses in detail. She describes the contents of garbage outside. She describes the sores of people that she witnessed. I do think it's incredible. And I do think it's impressive that she went into those places because, again, the mental toll of witnessing something like this, knowing that these people and these children will probably not even live. Like, she just mentions that the people that she visited passed away not long after. Just knowing that you can do nothing to help them, that even if you donated your whole fortune to them, you maybe could help like one family, but then how would you choose which family that is? And I think all of that frustration of not being able to do anything, she translated into this book, because you can definitely, definitely read the saltiness seeping through the text. She is just so upset. I would say she also exhibits surprisingly socialist views for the era. What I find interesting is, as I said, Edinburgh still has a housing crisis, especially now during the festival. Like, everyone just looking for a place. I personally met a person that stayed in a hostel for like 3 months when they moved to study to Edinburgh. And then I think it was someone else's sofa. So overall, for half a year, they could not find accommodation. Edinburgh is just really small. So I think that's still an issue nowadays. There is way more people that want to live there than should, I think. But what I like about Edinburgh is that you can feel that history. You can literally, like, if you walk those closes, you feel like a Victorian ragged woman is gonna jump from behind a corner. And that's what I like about it. I like that atmosphere because it's rare that you can feel history so deeply in a city and it has been untouched like Edinburgh for so long. And as awful as it sounds, I think when I go to Edinburgh again, I would probably walk these closes and just think of this text and imagine what it must have felt like, because it's probably a different experience than just focusing on the pretty buildings. That was tough. I'm glad I read it though, because I feel like I'm much more aware of what poverty was like in 19th century than I was before this text. Anyway, thank you for listening, and I'll hear you in another episode. Bye.